Hello and welcome to Jesuitical, a podcast by the young, hip, and lay editors of American Media. That lay part means we aren't Jesuits, but we work with them. Join us each week for a smart Catholic take on faith, culture, and the news, often over drinks. I'm Ashley McKinless, and I'm joined by Zach Davis.
Hello, Ashley. It's good to be with you.
Good to be with you, Zach. How are you doing?
It's good. The world's still falling apart, but otherwise, I mean, like, just dealing with the...
I feel like this has been the first week in a while without, like, a... I mean, besides, like, the major crisis that has been going on for months, but, like, no acute new big stories that have kept me up all night.
Yeah, no, there's just the pandemic, which is still simmering and raging back.
Yeah.
But we're post-election, post-McCarrick report, mm-hmm. So...
That doesn't mean we're not going to keep talking about both of those things.
That's right. Who are we talking to this week, Ashley?
We are talking to Father Sam Sawyer. He's our colleague here at America. He's a senior editor and our unofficial chief technology officer. He's the one to call when your laptop is broken. But he also wrote a really great piece for America Magazine last week titled, "The McCarrick Report Confirms It, Clericalism Powered the Sex Abuse Crisis."
Yeah, clericalism is this word that we talk about a lot, and we figured that it would be good to bring Sam on as a cleric, not to yell at him for clericalism, but to kind of have a frank conversation both about the McCarrick Report, but also how clericalism functions on a more day-to-day level in Catholic life.
Yep. And we're drinking one of Sam's favorite drinks while we have this conversation, which is a wintry twist on the Negroni. And I'm not going to try to say it. So, Zach, what's it called?
Yes. Sam loves Negronis, but in typical non-cleric fashion, he did make an accommodation for Ashley because she prefers whiskey. So we're drinking Boulevardiers, which is basically a Negroni, but you swap out the gin for some whiskey. So we're drinking one of those. The ingredients are bourbon, vermouth, Campari, and some orange peel for garnish, which is the second time we've had this on the show. And it is a favorite wintry drink of mine.
Mm-hmm.
So
it's great.
Cheers.
So cheers. Now it's time for Signs of the Times, the part of our show where we sift through the Catholic news of the week so you don't have to. What's our first story, Zach?
So this week is the annual meeting of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, and it's operating a little bit differently this year, like most meetings. Normally, they gather in person in Baltimore, and because of the coronavirus, they are gathering virtually this year, which means we're hearing a lot of, Your Excellency, you're muted.
Yeah, and I gotta say, it was a surprisingly uneventful meeting. I think I was expecting, because it was coming on the heels of the McCarrick Report and this very contentious election and the election of our second Catholic president, that, you know, that there'd be some spirited conversations about those topics, which is not exactly what we saw. Bishops did give kind of statements on the McCarrick Report, but we didn't really see any practical recommendations about how they might follow up on that.
Which I think a lot of people found frustrating, we should acknowledge and say.
Yes, agreed. And there was no talk of the election until the very last minute.
That's right. So on day two of the meeting and just minutes before the meeting ended, and we should say there wasn't like a press conference afterwards, which sometimes happens. So there was really no discussion about this. The USCCB president, Archbishop Jose Gomez, announced that several other bishops had approached him to, quote, express a particular concern in the wake of the election.
Right. And their concern was not that the sitting president has refused to concede that he has lost, but that a Catholic president, Joe Biden, who supports policies, quote, that are against the fundamental values we hold dear as Catholics, end quote, could cause confusion among the faithful.
Specifically, they mentioned Biden's support for abortion, the contraception mandate, and an LGBT rights bill that they think could curtail religious liberty.
Right. And so I think first it's important to say, like, what is the confusion they're worried about? Because I don't think anyone's confused about what the church teaches on these issues. And so what is it about having a Catholic president who is out of step with the church? Why is that a source of confusion, do you think?
Well, I think I agree with you, generally. I think they would say that having, you know, one of the most prominent Catholics in the country have this one view that is out of step with what the church teaches might cause confusion for, you know, the people watching at home.
I mean, but this guy was our vice president.
That's right.
No one's going to be surprised to learn this. We have plenty of other Catholic politicians. The Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, would be a Catholic of this mold. So I guess, yeah, is the confusion, you know, maybe Catholics wondering why the church isn't able to convince Joe Biden to follow church teaching?
I don't think that's what they're getting at. I think they are worried mm-hmm. that other Catholics will think it is, quote, okay to also mm-hmm. hold
so it
this
gives them permission.
Exactly. Yeah. Now, I don't think I've really ever met anyone who was confused about what the church teaches about abortion. So, yeah.
And I don't think I've met anyone who decided to change their view on abortion because a, you know, prominent politician told them to.
No, definitely not. So I think we get hung up on this a little bit, like that lay people are not, I don't know, as critical thinking as they actually are, and that they're going to be confused super easily. We should say that the bishops did note there are plenty of areas for common ground, specifically, you know, including work around climate change and immigration reform.
Right. So yeah, but I guess what I see this as is kind of, this is how they are deciding to, you know, it's their first step in framing what the relationship between the Bishops' Conference and the Biden administration is going to be. And if you do hope to see some work on those issues where there's common ground, it seems like this kind of maybe will make that harder if, you know, the first thing the bishops are saying collectively about Biden is that, you know, he's kind of problematic.
Yeah, I'm not sure what the strategy is here. Archbishop Gomez said they're creating this working group to figure out how to work with Biden. And Archbishop Gomez says that it's comparable to the one they created for migrants and refugees that was set up following the election of Donald Trump in 2016. But I'm not totally sure that that holds necessarily, right? Like, this was announced to sort of specifically navigate how to work with a Catholic president who doesn't hold certain Catholic views.
I was just gonna say, they both are working groups that are centered on policies where there's a clear divergence between the administration and Catholic teaching. So I get what they're saying there. So for Trump, their biggest concern was the ways that he departed from Catholic teaching on how to treat migrants. And for Biden, it's the ways he departs on life issues and issues of religious liberties. So I see that parallel. I guess that's not how they framed it. It really was like framed as something broader about the fact that he's Catholic and holds these views.
Yeah. And, you know, I think if I'm, you know, advising the bishops on how to, and for the record, I'm not, but if they were to come to me and ask me how should they work with the new Biden administration, the area that I would actually point to is climate change, right? And probably immigration, which one is one where they said there are areas of common ground. But I think there is a temptation for this administration to not actually, to kind of just keep the status quo with both of those issues, right? With both climate change and immigration reform, and just sort of like wait that out and not actually make a ton of progress. And I think there is a clear both political and moral mandate, right, that they could have a conversation with this administration to really push further on these things.
Yeah, I think that's right. And for the issues that they aren't going to see eye to eye with the administration, I want to make clear that I'm not saying that like the bishop should, you know, tone down their opposition to abortion or other issues like that. And I do think I think it's incumbent on Joe Biden as the first Catholic president to, I don't know, take the bishops in good faith when they make those positions clear. As a Catholic, he should know that our support for unborn life does not come from a place of hating women, but from, you know, a concern about the dignity of that life. So I hope that, you know, Biden's understanding of that will make, you know, hard discussions a little bit more possible. If the administration does start from that like point of presuming the best intentions of the other side.
But sometimes it's really tough to have hard conversations if this is the first sentence in the conversation.
Right.
And I think that's something that Pope Francis has pointed to in his papacy, is that, you know, we don't have to waver on our commitments to these issues, but if we are constantly referencing the same ones over and over again, it's really drowning out our ability to witness to what I think a lot of Catholics are worried about, is a whole life spectrum.
All right. Well, bishops, if you're listening, maybe try that. And now stick around for our conversation with Father Sam Sawyer. Joining us now from Manhattan is Father Sam Sawyer. Sam is a Jesuit priest and senior editor at America Media. He was also a lead producer on the Deliver Us podcast, which was America's deep dive on the abuse crisis. Welcome to Jesuitical, Sam.
It's really good to be here. Thanks.
Thanks. It's the premiere. It's your first time on the show. Thank you.
I know. Well, after watching Jesuitical, you know, grow and evolve from its very first pilot sessions and, you know, frequently losing certain people who work for me at odd hours to go record it, it's nice to finally be here in person.
Yes.
Yeah, we're just doing our part to keep you humble, Sam.
now, for your first time on the show, we've brought you on to yell at you about clericalism. So thanks for being our cleric in effigy.
Sounds good.
So Sam, we're talking to you the week after the Vatican released its long-awaited report on the rise and fall of the former Cardinal Theodore McCarrick. Again, bringing back to the headlines the sexual abuse crisis in the church. And people, whenever this comes up, they point to different things as the root cause, whether that's celibacy among the clergy, homosexuality, a lack of women in leadership. But you and others, including Pope Francis, have pointed to clericalism as you know, the central problem in this crisis. Why do you say that?
Well, so I think the first thing I want to be clear about is that I think clericalism is most clearly the central problem in the cover-up segment of the abuse crisis, right? There are lots of things we could talk about as far as what causes abuse or what allows abuse to persist. But when we look at the problem in the church of finding out about abusers and then not doing anything about it and covering up reports of abuse and not acting on them properly from a perspective of the people who are in charge, that's where I think clericalism is a really key part of the explanation of what went so deeply wrong in the church.
And maybe before we go further, if you could just maybe give us a like working definition of clericalism.
Sure. So for a working definition of clericalism, I'd say it's just the attitude that that people who are ordained, so mostly priests and bishops, but to a degree deacons as well, are by virtue of being ordained somehow better, have greater automatic authority, are not to be questioned, must be deferred to. So it's a way that authority and ordination get attached together in the church in a way that excludes criticism or involvement from lay people.
Right. And you read the entire McCarrick report. Where did you see evidence of clericalism operating most strongly?
Well, I mean, across the entire report, I think it's...
Would you say the report itself was a little bit...
So I think the report itself is starting to emerge from the shadow of clericalism a little bit, right? So the report was... the primary investigator in the report was an American attorney who the Vatican commissioned to go do this and do a bunch of interviews and pore through all the documents and write it up. So in that sense, you know, it is not purely clerical as an exercise. It's not just a report that's written by bishops in the Vatican, although it's still, of course, approved. It comes out of bishops in the Vatican commissioning the report. But the primary place I see clericalism, or the clearest pattern you see if you go through the report or just even, you know, read the executive summary of the report yourself, is that over and over again, the concern that is driving all the events in the report isn't a concern about whether or not McCarrick actually was hurting people, right? It's always a concern about whether or not there's going to be public scandal.
And what does the church mean by scandal, like there in particular?
So, I mean, ideally, what the church ought to mean by scandal And what the church means at scandal by scandal when the church is at its best is a concern for something that will diminish or block people's faith, right? So scandal comes from the Greek for a stumbling block. So it literally something that gets in the way of people having faith and believing in God. But practically, what it means in the report, what it meant for McCarrick, is scandal in the sense of something that'll make us, the bishops, the clerics, the priests, the people in charge of the church, something that'll make us look bad. And that's just sort of automatically equated to, if it makes us look bad, it will also be bad for people's faith. But of course, what we've learned over the now, you know, we're getting close to 20 years of the abuse crisis in the United States being well known in public discussion. And of course, what we've seen is that's what is causing people to lose faith, right? That the church hasn't dealt with this honestly and continues to have to be sort of dragged kicking and screaming into dealing with it all honestly. That's a much greater stumbling block to faith than public discussion of what's going on.
And where was maybe the most like egregious example of this in the McCarrick report?
So when I wrote about this for America last week, it's not that it's the most egregious example. It just happened to be a very compact example of it. So I picked an example that's found on three pages of the report, a letter that Cardinal Hickey, who was then Archbishop of Washington, D.C., so a position that McCarrick would later succeed to, but a letter that Cardinal Hickey writes in response to a request from the nuncio, which is to say the Pope's ambassador in the U.S., when rumors were swirling around McCarrick. So the background here is that it's 1994, might need to check that date, but they're preparing for John Paul II to come and visit the United States, one of his visits, and one of the proposed stops is in Newark, where McCarrick is at that point archbishop. And in the preparation, in the run-up for this visit, one of the concerns that's expressed and that comes to the nuncio is that there are these rumors around McCarrick, and if the Pope goes to visit his archdiocese, possibly these rumors will hit the press and be discussed publicly, and so we should check and figure out whether or not this is really a problem. And so the nuncio consults around, and one of the people he consults with is Cardinal Hickey in D.C., and Hickey writes this letter where he defends McCarrick, but the logic of his defense, I think, is a near perfect example of clericalism. Hickey basically says that in light of his many years of devoted service and his well-deserved reputation as a churchman beyond reproach, I'm quoting there, that McCarrick should be presumed completely innocent. And when I was reading the whole report, that leapt out to me because here we have a cardinal of the church saying that the presumption of innocence here is not just a presumption that should be accorded to anyone as a matter of justice and due process, but rather that McCarrick deserves some sort of specific presumption of innocence because he is a talented, accomplished, and eminent churchman, right? Which I think is just the definition of clericalism. And you see in this letter how Hickey, by focusing on McCarrick as a fellow churchman, as another eminent bishop, talks himself out of even the possibility of imagining that there could really be anything wrong here that would require further follow-up or any action on his part or on the part of anyone else.
Because he served the church for so long and he must be one of the quote-unquote good guys.
Well, because he served the church for so long. And the other thing that's in Hickey's letter is sort of talking himself into disbelieving the accuser, right? So there's the accuser is painted as sort of ideologically unreliable. And the accuser in this case is actually a priest who is alleging that McCarrick mistreated him when he was a seminarian. The channel through which this allegation got passed to the nuncio is the superior of a women's religious community. And she's sort of dismissed as, well, she just wants to make herself sound important. And so it's anyone who's not a bishop, right? So in this case, they're even dismissing other clerics, this other priest, and religious, this superior of the women's religious community. But anyone who's not at their level of clerical status is unreliable, doesn't really have to be taken quite that seriously.
Is there anything in the report or in the way that it's been received among U.S. bishops that suggests there's an awareness of the way that clericalism is operating here?
So I think the report itself is a sign of some of that awareness, right? The most surprising thing in the report to me, surprising in a positive sense, is that the report is so thorough and that it lays out with such clarity some of the internal deliberations, particularly the internal deliberations at the Vatican around how bishops get appointed. That's not something you really ever hear people talking about publicly. And so the fact that the report was willing to put some of that on the table, I think is both kind of a crack in the wall of clericalism a little bit, but also a sign that, as Pope Francis has said many times, that this is being recognized as a problem, that these sort of completely insulated and isolated circles of discussion and power and authority are part of what's driven the abuse crisis.
I want to hone in on something here, because I think you've got corporations, you know, all throughout the world that can be accused of treating serious moral problems just like their PR crises. What specifically is different in this case? Is it just that it's involving clerics, or is there something like more deeply spiritually sinful at work here?
So I'm going to give the classic Catholic both and answer here. Both those things are the case. So I think part of clericalism is just, in one sense, the Catholic name for the sort of sociological phenomenon of in-group protection, right? As you said, you see this all over in any institution. It'll happen in corporations. People will protect others like themselves. People will, particularly people in power, will tend to disbelieve or find reasons to push off accusations from people outside their circle of power. And that happens everywhere. That's not special or specific to the church. I think the things about it that are specific to the church are the church's structures of authority, at least the ones that are solidly linked to ordination, have a very long on-ramp, and you can only get in at the very first step. Right, which is to say, the only way to be a bishop is to first have been a priest. The only way to be a priest is to first have been a seminarian. And so you've got a pool of people who enter into those circles of power that have been on that road for decades. And there's no one else who gets into that funnel. There's a smaller, more insular group of people in that circle by the time you get to the highest levels of power. But the other thing that I think is different about clericalism in the church, what makes it spiritually damaging, is that what, you know, I'm a priest. What we priests are supposed to do is to minister to people on behalf of God, right? And become for them in some way a representation of Jesus and how Jesus ministers to and loves the church. And so when that ministry is distorted through clericalism, when it's used for self-protection and for self-interest instead of for the good of the people whom it's supposed to serve, then that is spiritually damaging in a profound way.
That's a good pivot to talk about your own vocation and ministry, because you joined the Jesuits in 2002.
2004.
Oh, sorry, 2004. In Boston, is that right?
I did.
And this was, you know...
Well, from Boston. The novitiates, yeah. In Syracuse.
Yeah, so this was, you know, soon after the Boston abuse crisis became public. How did entering the priesthood, you know, obviously it was a long journey from there, but how did that shape your own ministry?
You know, I remember, and I've written about this for America, when I was discerning specifically about applying to the Jesuits and entering, I was going to daily mass at the Jesuit church on the corner of BC's campus, which at the time, right across the street from the church and the campus, was the chancery of the Archdiocese of Boston. And so at any given point, you know, I had a rough barometer of how bad the news in the scandal was that day by counting the number of satellite trucks parked outside the chancery.
So you are actively thinking about becoming a priest when this is just like blowing up.
Oh yeah. And, you know, fellow parishioners at my church in Boston are disappointed and scared and mad as hell at the church, and all of that's going on at the same time. My family certainly was, people in my family were skeptical about it. I would say my experience, the way that hit my discernment, it didn't scare me so much, but it made me more sober about what I was actually looking to do. right? Because it made it very clear that I was asking to step into a kind of life where, as much as there would be people for whom I would be a great gift and who would receive me warmly, there were also very definitely going to be people who looked at me with suspicion. And I would say that's been true. You know, I've been received overall much more warmly by people as a Catholic priest than people have shown suspicion of me. But I've certainly have experienced over the last now, you know, 16 years of religious life and 6 years of priesthood, people who come to a Catholic priest with a certain amount of automatic suspicion because of what they've learned through these years of the abuse scandal.
Are there moments where you've experienced like the temptation to clericalism? Because I have to imagine like lay people like myself have to play a role in this, because I know I've been guilty of just sort of, it's easier to default, put you guys on a pedestal sometimes.
So I want to come back to the question of have I experienced the temptation, because, well, in one sense, because I'm probably, you know, not the most reliable gauge of that. And you should ask the people who work with me, you know, some of whom might be on this interview, whether or not I succumb to that temptation. But one place I remember seeing this through the, you know, at least the first year of my priesthood, every time I went to a new parish and was kind of getting, you know, the orientation tour, right? So you show up in the sacristy 20 minutes before Mass, and somebody tells you, like, here's your microphone, here's, you know, this is what order we're going to do things in, and this is, you know, where you line up for the procession, and all those logistical details you need to run Mass. Very often, in fact, almost across the board, someone would ask me, oh, Father, how do you want the altar set up? Or how do you want to do, you know, the distribution of communion at this particular time? Or how do you want to do this? How do you want to do that? And my answer would always be, what do you do here? You know, that's what I want to do. I want to do whatever the normal thing is here. And, you know, at one level, people were just trying to be hospitable. And I think, you know, certainly at least in the early days, there was also the fear that, like, you know, this guy might not know what he's doing, so we should at least find out what he thinks he's doing. But underneath that as well is this sense of like, well, we can't tell you what to do. You're the priest. I'm like, yeah, but I've never been here to your parish before, so you need to tell me what to do because I have no idea what you ordinarily do here. And that is just, you know, sort of like a small capsule example of, I think, the ways that there's this built-in expectation that, like, because I'm a priest, I already know how all this works, or even if I don't know, I already have my own agenda for how all this works.
Well, and as someone who has worked with you and for you for majority of your priesthood, I will say that I want to give you a little bit of permission to not congratulate yourself, but like, I certainly could not work for a priest who is clerical, right? I think I've said before, I'm not necessarily a yes man all the time. And you, it's something I have noticed about you, and, you know, you really do resist this temptation to just retreat into your authority, either as my boss or as a Jesuit priest. So I'm just like, what is the secret sauce? Maybe if there are priests or other lay people listening out there.
First of all, thank you for that. I think one of the things that does it for me that I find most helpful in that is, you know, basic from Ignatian spirituality, the daily examine. So just checking in on a daily basis about what I've been experiencing, where God has been in it, because it gives me an opportunity to find those moments where I realize, oh, yeah, I really didn't know what was going on there, right? Or I made a boneheaded call, and then I get a chance to look at, well, why did I make that boneheaded call, right? Did I do that because I didn't get enough input? Did I do that because I was feeling, you know, vulnerable or uncertain, and I just grabbed at something that looked secure? Definitely a disciplined practice of prayer, and specifically the daily examine. But above and beyond that is just, I think, the willingness to be wrong about things, right? To not feel like it's my job to know in advance how things are supposed to go.
I'm glad that's how you answer the question, because I think there's, among some Catholics, a more superficial fix. Or they, you know, they think the answer is more superficial. It's like, oh, well, you know, priests should stop wearing their clerics and wear normal clothes, and we shouldn't have to call them father. But in my own experience, I've met, you know, priests and cassocks who are not clericalists at all. And I've met Jesuits in flannels who, you know, insist that I call them by their first name, but do fall into it. So I'm glad that your response was, you know, prayer and reflection, not just like being the cool casual priest.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, I think clericalism is much more about whether or not you're able to be corrected in a sense mm-hmm. than it is about any external trappings of authority or priestly office.
Yeah. Do you think it's wrong for lay Catholics to hold priests up to a higher or different standard?
No, I certainly don't think it's wrong for lay Catholics to hold priests to a higher standard. And there are some aspects of a different standard. Like, you know, we have different obligations, right? There are standards that apply to me in terms of particularly my formal obedience to the hierarchy of the church that apply to a priest differently than they would apply to a lay Catholic. But I would say, you know, I hope that we hold anyone who's trying to be holy, who's trying to serve other Christians as a minister of the gospel in some way, I hope we hold anyone who sets out on that path to a higher standard. And in that sense, there's nothing special about holding priests to a higher standard. It's just that priest means for everyone deliberately volunteering to be a minister of the gospel. So yeah, everyone who's going to try to be a minister of the gospel needs to be held to a standard of service and compassion and care that is, I would hope, higher than whatever our default is.
Yeah, it just seems like there is this tension between empowering the laity, right, and saying, you know, you are the church and you're part of it, and that it was the clerics that really did enable this abuse and this cover up, and still trying to, in this aftermath, like, not throw the baby out with the bathwater, right? Like, to understand what are, you know, like, proper relationships between clerics and laity, and what power looks like in the church and where it should be. What are some like practical steps you think that we either as lay members of the church or as clerics can take to sort of start to resolve some of that?
I think the first and maybe most significant thing I would say about that is that one of the questions to be asked of any priest, of any bishop, but also I would suggest by lay people about any priest or bishop who's serving them is, does this man seek advice? Is this man correctable? Can he hear a critique and receive it and change his mind about things? Does he talk to people? And does he talk to people not pro forma, but to actually learn what their needs are, what their thoughts about how he's doing in his ministry are? Can he really hear people as equals and as partners and not just as, quote unquote, the people in the pews? That, I think, is maybe the most critical thing. And there are process implications for that, certainly, about involving lay people in boards of review and other formal structures in the church that deal either specifically with the abuse crisis or with questions about, you know, like reviewing seminarians as they come up for ordination. Or I would hope that we eventually find ways to involve input from lay people in a deeper way when we're considering who we identify as candidates to be appointed bishops.
Bishops and also pastor, I feel like the experience of most Catholics, you know, they might not be totally clued in on who their bishop is, but like most of the time, just Father so-and-so just randomly shows up when it's time to reshuffle assignments. And there's not a ton of at least visible input from the community, even though there might be behind the scenes, it still feels like it's maybe the old boys club shuffling the ranks.
Right. And there I'd say, and I have honestly no idea how to solve this, but more often than not, at least in present day, I think the challenge there is not just an unwillingness or a disinterest in hearing input from lay people in the parish, but the fact that most bishops, when it comes time to assign a new pastor, like it's not actually like they have a whole lot of options necessarily, right? Just given the number of priests and people who are available, sometimes, and I think unfortunately, most of the time, it's closer to plugging a hole than picking the right person.
Yeah. So for those of us who are working within the church, it can be kind of disheartening to talk about this, like how the church is broken. But I think, I don't know, maybe we can find some hope in the fact that we're talking about this and we're seeing people trying to be proactive about empowering lay people and holding clerics accountable. So I'm wondering, you know, what in this moment do you see that is hopeful? And how do you personally stay spiritually grounded and not falling into despair when we have these conversations?
Honestly, one of the things I think is deeply hopeful here is the fact that there are lay people who are more publicly dissatisfied with the status quo and are willing to say so, and are not simply accepting the kind of automatic reassurance that everything's okay, or that, you know, well, we've looked at this and we've, you know, tweaked some procedures around the edges and now it's all fine. I find the fact that people are unwilling to accept that, or at least the people who are most deeply invested in their faith are unwilling to accept that. I actually find that deeply hopeful, because I think it is on the path to something changing in the church. And honestly, I don't know what that change will look like yet, right? I suspect that, over the course of, certainly over the course of my priestly life, but probably even over the course of the next 10 or 20 years, you know, closer in than that, the shape of parish life in the United States is going to transform drastically, in part because of the number of priests available, but in part also because the demographics of parishes are going to change. And I think the people who are deeply invested in parish life are going to kind of vote with their feet about which parishes actually meet them where they are and offer them something that feeds them spiritually. And yeah, I don't know what that's going to look like yet, but I think I have a pretty deep trust and certainly a great hope that God is at work in that transformation in ways that we don't necessarily expect, that we can't predict, and that we will learn about and learn to be grateful for, mostly in hindsight.
That you said that with such hope that it's hard to be mad about it. But man, that is sort of maddening.
Well,
that is the gospel, I suppose.
I mean, this is something. It's certainly something I see deeply in Pope Francis's ministry, and no surprise here. It's something I attribute to his formation in Ignatian spirituality, because Ignatius says, "Let the creator deal directly with the creature and the creature directly with its creator and Lord," which is sort of a slightly more eloquent and poetic way of saying God's actually in charge here.
Yeah. It's your church, Lord. I'm going to bed. Yeah,
basically. Right. And which doesn't excuse anyone of the responsibility to actually do every bit of work that's in your power and that is actually yours to do. But it is to say that ultimately the success or failure of the church is not a matter of how well we either understand the problem or plan for the solution. The success or failure of the church is a matter of God being faithful to the church, and God is.
Amen. I think it's a good place to wrap. Sam, thank you for coming on to talk about this very fraught subject, although I feel like you run an expertise in fraught subjects. So, much appreciated. We do have one final question for you, and I think you know it's coming. If you could canonize one person, living or dead, Catholic or not, fictional or real, who would it be and why?
So I did know this was coming and spent some time thinking about it. And the person I've decided on is Denise Levertov, who's an American poet from the 20th century, a convert to Christianity, and then later on a convert to Catholicism once she was already a Christian, who died in 1997. And one of the reasons I've loved Levertov's poetry for a long time, going back at least to my own college days, and one of the reasons I find her poetry so powerful is because it's willing to grapple with the thorny questions and not try to get an answer for them, right? But simply to say, here's the question, it's kind of a mess, and we're in the middle of it. but there is a beauty in that that's pulled out of her poetry. She was also, in addition to being a great poet, a peace activist during the Vietnam War, you know, kind of a gadfly figure in some ways. But and I have no idea how much of this will make it into the recording, but I actually grabbed a poem of hers that I thought kind of captures, it's short and might capture some of the places we are these days.
I would love to hear that.
So the poem's called On the Mystery of the Incarnation. It's when we face for a moment the worst our kind can do and shudder to know the taint in our own selves, that awe cracks the mind shell and enters the heart, not to a flower, not to a dolphin, to no innocent form, but to this creature vainly sure it and no other is godlike. God, out of compassion for our ugly failure to evolve, entrusts, as guest, as brother, the word.
Amen. Well, Saint Denise, pray for us. Sam, thank you so much. We're going to plug the piece that you just wrote for us, where people can find that at americamagazine.org. But people can also find your thoughts on twitter.com. What is your handle?
S. Sawyer SJ.
Yes, the most civil voice you're going to find on Twitter, I think it's fair to say.
Sanity is my brand.
All right. Thank you, Sam.
Thanks so much.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Hi there, it's Ashley.
And Zach.
If you're looking for another podcast that features inspiring conversations with theologians, ministers, and pastors, then I recommend adding the acclaimed show No Small Endeavor to your podcast queue.
Each episode, host and award-winning theologian Lee C. Camp brings you thoughtful conversations with special guests, like the Queen of Christian Pop, Amy Grant, and pastor and theologian Tish Harrison Warren, about what it means to find true happiness and flourish in our everyday life.
As The Guardian said, No Small Endeavor is a must listen, and I couldn't agree more. So don't miss out. Follow No Small Endeavor on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you're listening now, and tell them we sent you. All right, now it's time for some housekeeping. First, we want to give a shout out to the new members of our Patreon community. We've got Amy Whitman, Ruth O'Connor, and Katie and Chris Sousen.
Yeah, thanks so much for signing up to support the show. We hope you're enjoying the benefits that come with supporting our Patreon page, including our reading group, which is still happening. If you are still on the fence about joining, there is still time to log on, pledge to support the show. You can get access to all three of the conversations that have already happened. And you can join our fourth and final one, which is happening the Thursday after Thanksgiving live. And so you can hit all that at patreon.com/americamedia.
And we also want to put in a plug for two podcasts from the American Media Network that are coming this Advent. So for The Word, which is our regular scriptural reflection podcast here at America, we ramp it up during the Advent season, and there will be reflections from editors at American Media every day throughout Advent.
Yeah, and we'll be narrating them, so you might hear our voices. And we also want to point you to a new special edition of our Imagine podcast. So Tucker Redding, SJ, who you might remember, he was on this podcast to talk about Ignatian imaginative prayer, produced season one of Imagine, and he's coming back with a 6-part Advent season that's going to guide you through the journey with Mary and Joseph and imagining scenes that lead up to the Christmas story and the birth of Christ.
Yes, so wherever you find your favorite podcast, go subscribe to The Word and Imagine.
And just one final housekeeping note. We are taking Thanksgiving off, and so we will be counting in our number of gratitudes this year. Might seem like there aren't a lot of things to be grateful for, but I know, and we really do mean this, we are grateful for you and this community that have built up this podcast for what it is. So keep us in your prayers this Thanksgiving, and you will be in ours.
Yeah, we'll see you in Advent.
That's right.
Yeah, I know. It's next Sunday.
Oh, boy.
All right. And now it's time for Consolations and Desolations, the part of the show where we talk about where we found God in our lives this week and where it was harder to find God. What do you have, Zach?
I got a desolation. And it, I guess it starts with like, I don't know, holidays are coming. And I personally like find these, it to be like a pretty stressful time. And that is more so the case this year. I feel like this started sneaking up at the same time where I was hitting like a, I don't know, one of these like coronavirus, like bad days where just everything seems dark and terrible and it's never going to end. And, I kind of reached a breaking point and, I don't know, was not in a good place. And compounding that, one of the normal things I would reach to deal with like stress like this, working out, I'm like trying not to go to the gym anymore. That's gone. And normally like my faith is like a huge part of how I deal with stress, I would say. But praying on my own is not one of my readily like go-to tools, right? Like normally I can just show up to mass and sit and let it like wash over me. And that is harder to do now. And when I'm in the midst of this like freak out or crisis and all these problems that need solved and all these things that need done, the thing that I'm worried about is just getting something done. And Father Eric was asking me like, well, did you pray about it? And I was like, after a little bit of back and forth, I was like, no, I didn't pray because that is seen as like some sort of luxury that I can do once I've figured something out. And because it's not productive in that way, it's not something that I like regularly turn to. And it's, you know, instead of doing that, what I'm actually doing is sort of retreating into myself, freaking out about stuff and withdrawing from like other human relationship as well. So like definition, desolation. And so, yeah, I don't know, gave it a little bit of time, had a nice tea, and things are still terrible, but I am trying to work on, you know, learning to still be human, still be committed to my prayer life, and being okay with it, not going to fix everything, which is so maddening, but it is the way, as the Mandalorian would say.
Yeah, I feel you. And that kind of connects to my consolation, which is one of those consolations that did not feel like a consolation, as I mean, you know, it didn't feel nice is what I'll say. So I guess it was Tuesday night. I kind of went into a similar spiral that you described, Zach. It was, you know, it was one of those nights where I was tossing and turning till like 3 a.m. just thinking about going home for Thanksgiving, being around family members who are, you know, vulnerable, older, have pre-existing conditions, that sort of thing, and just kind of panicking. And that panic, you know, kind of prompted an examination of conscience for me, because it was like, okay, like why are you freaking out now? Like you've gone back to Virginia to see your family before. Like, is this really that different? And I think, you know, what I had to do is reflect, and like the reason I was really panicking is because like I was looking back on my last couple weeks and realizing that like I let my guard down. I have had corona fatigue and I'm sick of being alone in my apartment, and there are interactions I've had where I look back and I'm like, no, I wish I had been more careful in that situation. And so I, you know, really saw that, you know, I haven't been putting, you know, my concern about other people, especially leading back to this holiday first. So the consolation in that is that I was prompted to, you know, listen to my conscience and God kind of prodding me to do that. And, you know, Father Sundrup described something from the exercises, and it's, you know, when you're going from pleasure to pleasure, God's intervention isn't going to feel good. It's it's going to disrupt that. And so I think I kind of got some a good wake up call from God this week, going into Thanksgiving.
A little God intervention.
Yeah. So, you know, I'm going to get my COVID test and be a better citizen going forward.
Yeah. It's hard and takes a lot of guts to, I don't know, face up to yourself and to mm-hmm. God. Always, yeah, it's better. It's always easier to just kind of shirk that, in my opinion. But I admire you for staring it in the face.
Yeah.
All right. Get us out of here.
All right. Judgmental is produced by Maggie Van Dorn. Our editor is Noah Levinson. Faith Formation provided by Father Eric Sundrup. You can follow us on Twitter at Judgmental Show. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/groups/judgmental. Please subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your favorite podcasts and leave us a review. Judgmental is a production of American Media in New York City. For American Media, I'm Ashley McKinless with Zach Davis. We'll see you in 2 weeks.